Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is audio from a webinar titled Defend Socialist China. We'll start with China scholar Keith Bennett. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station.
When the People's Republic of China was founded in 1949, China was one of the very poorest societies and countries on earth. The subsequent political and economic trajectory of the People's Republic essentially falls into two distinct phases, with the second commencing with the launch of the policy, which is known as reform and opening up, from the end of 1978. The achievements of the first period, the Mao era, should not be underestimated or denigrated. They were among the most stupendous in human history. Life expectancy in China grew by 1 year for every year that Mao was in power. From being practically the poorest country on earth, Mao's China solved the basic problems of feeding, clothing, housing, and educating almost a quarter of the world's population, provided basic medical care to the whole population, brought literacy to the overwhelming majority, massively improved the social position and role of women, and so on, a whole range of further social and economic and political achievements. So why then was it necessary to make such a radical turn in policy in 1978? For all its progress, China remained at the time of Mao's death in 1976 a very poor country, although the basic necessities of life, as I've outlined, were more or less guaranteed. Whilst famine had been eliminated, food was still strictly rationed. Although disparities and inequalities remained, China under Mao may be considered to have been one of the most equal societies on earth, but to a considerable extent, it could be described as a socialism of shared poverty. Moreover, at this time, huge changes were underway globally. Countries and regions around China were developing rapidly, albeit in many cases highly inequitably. However, this capitalist development in the region was then skillfully turned into a positive factor by China as its principal source of investment in the first stage of reform. For China at the time, such investment was crucial. It provided what the country desperately needed, a faster pace of industrialization and employment for those living in the countryside that could enable them to begin urban life, guaranteed export markets, skills and technology transfer, capital, technical and vocational training, and advanced scientific management. None of this would have been possible, at least not on the same scale, to the same extent, and at such a rapid pace, without the foundations that had been laid during the period of Mao's leadership. That is, without a basically educated, literate, and trained workforce, without housing and medical care, without a transportation network and paved roads that link to the whole country. And this is a major reason why Xi Jinping, from practically his first remarks when he was elected General Secretary of the party for his first term in 2012, has consistently stressed that the two phases of China's socialist development should not be counterposed to one another, but rather should be seen as two parts of a single revolutionary whole, one resting and building on the foundations laid by the other. In the last 4.5 decades since the reform period began, from a marginal position, China has become the world's second largest economy. It is the biggest manufacturer, largest exporter, and the major trading partner for 2/3 of the world's nations. It has rocketed up the value chain, increasingly leading the world in innovation and R&D. In just a few years, the whole country has been covered in a network of high-speed rail, accounting for some 70% of the world's total. Of course, no change as rapid and radical and on so vast a canvas as the process of reform in China could possibly unfold without, as a secondary aspect, some negative features. And these are essentially what Xi Jinping has been working tirelessly to correct since he assumed the leadership, inaugurating what the Chinese now call a new era, meaning a new stage in the long march towards developed socialism. Among the key features of this new era that we can identify are a merciless and ceaseless campaign against corruption, a rectification of the party's ranks, decisively returning to the concept of serving the people, a massive targeted campaign resulting in the historically unprecedented elimination of extreme poverty across the whole country, with careful follow-up to ensure that people do not slip back and that their lives continue to improve. Tackling pollution, preserving the environment, safeguarding biodiversity, and leading the global fight against climate catastrophe. Rolling out by far the world's largest program of medical care and insurance and old age pensions. Ensuring that all sectors of the economy work in the overall interests of socialism, a reaffirmation of the central and guiding role of Marxism, and increasingly proactive foreign policy with the strategic goal of building a community of shared future for humanity and featuring increased support for and solidarity with the other socialist countries and a more dynamic engagement with a broad range of progressive forces internationally. Whilst China remains, in its own words, in the primary stage of socialism, the overall goal now is to build a modern socialist country in all respects by 2049, when the People's Republic will celebrate its 100th founding anniversary. And such an achievement will truly be something that will change the world. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. We just heard China scholar Keith Bennett. Next up is independent journalist and geopolitical analyst Danny Haifeng.
Right now we are in Trump 2.0. It is here. And I want to talk about how in the United States, we end up being captive to narrative and spin, to cults of personality and their hubris. Individualism is powerful, class consciousness and organization in the United States, not so much. So in this context, we actually find ourselves caught in this vortex of obsessing over Donald Trump. And indeed, Donald Trump puts on a show. Hundreds of executive orders and endless political theater acts have many Americans' heads spinning. Is Trump a peacemaker? Is he going to end the wars in Ukraine and elsewhere? Is a golden age of America coming? In my opinion, these are all the wrong questions, and China teaches us this quite dramatically. Why is this? Well, the United States is an empire. It is ruled by capitalist elites who see China as their principal threat. And they've spoken this through Trump's team. During his confirmation hearing, Marco Rubio, little Marco Rubio, called China the biggest threat to the United States. And his first meeting as a so-called top diplomat, if such a thing actually exists in the United States, was with the anti-China Quad, Australia, India, Japan, and of course, the United States. Yet at the same time, before Donald Trump was sworn in as president-elect, he said on the first days of his administration, he wanted the U.S. and China to solve the world's problems together. But we have to look underneath these contradictions to find the singular goal of the U.S. empire, and that is the weakening and containment of China. It isn't working. Trump isn't actually a signal of strength, despite a lot of the fear that many people rightfully and maybe wrongfully have of his new administration. He is a sign, actually, of a decaying empire. And you can see the weakness everywhere. Trump has clearly outlined a pivot back to the Western Hemisphere. Greenland, Mexico, Latin America, and the Panama Canal are all now in the empire's crosshairs. It isn't new. It's actually quite old. It's reminiscent of the mid-19th century drive of the United States toward manifest destiny. And while the U.S. empire has the means to cause utter destruction, we've seen that in Gaza, we've seen that in Ukraine, Trump's current trajectory is actually, in my estimation, a concession of long-term strategic defeat for the United States' empire. Because despite Rubio's bloviating that China is the United States' principal threat, China will not and cannot be contained, nor it is actually a threat. The explosion of Americans' use of the Chinese application Red Note has already taught millions of Americans in just weeks of time why China is not a threat to them. Quite the contrary, China offers an example of a prospering society that is increasing the standard of living of the people there. Chinese tech is not based on theft, nor is its economy declining. Actually, China has just surpassed the United States in another realm of technology, open source AI, artificial intelligence, and its steady 5% GDP growth, replete with state-of-the-art infrastructure, has no end in sight. U.S. sanctions on Chinese tech have failed. U.S. militarization, the encirclement of China in the Asia Pacific, has failed. The U.S. under Trump truly does not know how to approach China at this time. It is certain, however, and we have to be very clear about this, that the aggression will ramp up again. After all, Rubio's words are not actually his own. They're the concoction of a so-called national security strategy that was adopted under Trump's first presidential administration and continued and escalated in Biden's administration. So let us deal with the facts when it comes to China under Trump 2.0. Fact number one, while rhetoric may come and go, get more hostile at times and less at others, the overall trend of U.S. imperial aggression toward China remains on the upward trajectory, regardless of whatever duopoly party is in the Oval Office. Obama began the pivot to Asia and sent 60%+ of the United States military, naval, and other assets to China's doorstep. Trump then added sanctions and tariffs and propaganda war, color revolution style interference. And then Biden increased all of this under the guise of strategic competition. In fact, number two, which is going to be critical in the Trump administration that we find ourselves in, short of nuclear war, China simply cannot be stopped. Short of nuclear war, China is primed to defend its sovereignty with a state-of-the-art military. Its economy is robust and has planning mechanisms that ensure flexibility and rapid changes when conditions require it. Its political system is arguably the most legitimate in the world, enjoying widespread popular support. Its economic integration with the world's poorest peoples and nations ensure that the foundations of a new development path are being built, ones that foster resilience in the multipolar world and move away from the fragile and crisis-ridden U.S.-led unipolar world. Its own Belt and Road Initiative is now 200+ countries strong and $1 trillion U.S. dollars in total development. This is not to mention China's leading role in the BRICS and other multilateral mechanisms, which China plays a central role. And then fact number three, maybe the most important fact of all here, is that the U.S. empire is in fact a declining empire, no matter how it may look on the world stage in places like West Asia. Syria, we saw the fall of Syria, which was devastating to the anti-war and anti-imperialist movement. We've witnessed the 1+ year now, a year and a half of genocide in Gaza and so many other world calamities. But none of these have actually strengthened the empire's hand. The U.S. simply cannot hold on to West Asia. It's losing its dominance there every single day. It's already lost legitimacy in much of Latin America. It has no presence in Africa beyond military occupation and provocations. This means it will rely on increasingly military means to get the empire's dirty dealings done. And that includes to provoke China. There is no other option the United States has at this point. But the problem is that the United States actually can't get into a hot war with China. That would be absolutely suicidal, not only for the total global economy, capitalist and otherwise, but also because all the war games have shown that the United States cannot win this war, that it ends up being a stalemate or a draw. However, the war makers and think tanks like the Center for New American Security want to spin it. But the truth is that the United States couldn't defeat Korea, could not defeat Vietnam, could not defeat Afghanistan, could not defeat the people of Palestine in Gaza who were fighting urban guerrilla warfare under the rubble. The United States empire simply cannot defeat really anybody at this time. Suffering caused? Absolutely yes. Defeat and victory? Absolutely not. So the only option the United States has with China, the only way it will get to this overall strategic competition finality, this grand ending toward the war to end all wars is nuclear war. That's the only option left in the United States' arsenal. And that's why this moment is incredibly critical. This means that we are all in danger until we confront the forces that are moving us toward war with China. The closer the United States' empire gets toward war with China, the closer we are ultimately to nuclear war. China has nuclear weapons and tested its first in 1964 and never let go of the no first use policy. The United States has already used nuclear weapons and has shown that it's willing to spend trillions of dollars to renew them, to create more of them, and has already, under the Biden administration before Trump, talked about how it is going to revamp its nuclear strategy in case of the need for future use of nuclear weapons. China was included on its list of the DPRK, Russia, and Iran. So all of this is to say is that this is where we are right now. And the Trump administration is having to navigate contradictions that it simply cannot navigate. And what is going to end up happening is that we saw this in the first Trump administration. There will be a bit of a honeymoon, a bit of a cooling period. The Trump administration, like most U.S. administrations, cannot afford, short of a crisis like 9/11, to simply jump into war at this time. But make no mistake, there's 4 years of this Trump administration, as long as the United States is the empire, the capitalist empire that it is. And I believe we will see soon enough the United States under Trump reorient itself back to China. Little Marco Rubio and the rest of his team are primed to do it. And that means we are all going to have to be ready to oppose these anti-China narratives, to expose people to the real China, and to build those people-to-people ties and the necessary solidarity to ensure that we roll back this war machine once and for all. Thank you.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. We just heard independent journalist and geopolitical analyst Danny Haifong. Next up is Sanyika of the All African People's Revolutionary Party.
I think everyone is pretty well aware of the propaganda in line that China is colonizing Africa, one of the most like pedestrian talking points. But it is one that, as a member of the African People's Revolutionary Party, we have to be prepared to dispel and explain to people exactly why that is propaganda. Because even in law school, I hear this line every day. But I think it's important that we go over what colonialism actually is. And so I'm going to go on the Frantz Fanon note here, where he describes colonialism as a system of violent dispossession, which is depriving someone of land and property, and hyper-exploitation. And as Frantz Fanon says, colonialism is violence. This is not because of simple racist feelings or rhetoric, but it is a system of resource extraction and economic exploitation that restructures the world into civilized nations and uncivilized savages. This rhetoric is actually one of the most important components of colonialism, and it's one of the ones that you don't necessarily truly see on the Chinese side today when you try to compare Chinese resource extraction with European resource extraction in the African context. And this manifests in the way that we divide the world into the West and the Third World / the Global South. Note that the world has already been divided into the West, or so-called First World, and the Third World. And so the relationship that exists between China and Africa, as we see, has steadily grown into the world consciousness, and it is at its peak for sure. But with this, there are different receptions, I guess, across the so-called international community, which is often full of Westerners, giving their opinions and kind of applying them universally. Some would say this renewed interest in Africa by China is simply a new stage of colonialism, with the Chinese at the helm of the vast exploitation of African nation, as opposed to her former European administrators. This analysis, however poetic and moralistic, is uncompelling once viewed in the light of the material and complex reality of Chinese investment on the continent. It also lacks an understanding of not only Chinese political and economic priorities, but also African interests. So in order to do that, we have to look at the root of China's engagement with Africa. And I will be honest here, we're going to start the clock when the PRC itself was founded. Anything before that is not relevant to the current administration, I guess you could say, in China. So the history of PRC-Africa relations goes back all the way to 1945. The notion that China has a sudden interest in Africa must be rejected on its premises. The founding of the People's Republic of China was hallmarked by its militant internationalism and hope in the revolutionary potential of the Third World. Out of 22 non-communist countries that established diplomatic relations with the PRC between 1958 and 1965, 17 of them were African. 14 sub-Saharan African nations established diplomatic ties with the PRC immediately following its independence. It is in Revolutionary Guinea that China found one of its first close allies in Ahmed Sékou Touré, who is one of the founders of the All African People's Revolutionary Party. And so between 1960 and 1969, a loan from the PRC financed the construction of Guinea's first oil processing factory, a bamboo processing center, a cigarette and match factory, a tea plantation, and more. We're going to see this trend as we look through Pan-African figures that I've listed here into what exactly their priorities were when engaging with China and how similar they are to China's priorities on the continent even today. So I would say, right, and we're not going to do a full history session, but the true foundations of modern China's policy towards Africa actually lie in the often overlooked Bandung Conference. This is the ideological and political predecessor to the Non-Aligned Movement. This is a convening of Afro-Asian cooperation, and it laid out the primacy of the struggle against colonialism, neocolonialism, and imperialism, and it opted out of Cold War bipolarity in favor of cooperative economic development. Big emphasis on cooperative economic development because that is basically the baseline of China-Africa relations in the PRC age. So China aided and financed the construction of what is famous in Africa and known as the Tanzim Railway that connected the newly independent states of Tanzania and Zambia. And this construction effort resulted in a government revenue deficit of 1.2 billion RMB. And this is before pre-reform China. So China taking on this huge loan for the effort of showing solidarity to these newly independent African nations really does not explain itself well under a colonialist framework here. I will end that by saying China's interests in partnership with African nations have been an essential foundation for the very principles of the PRC itself. In 1978, China supported aid programs in more African countries than the United States did. And understanding the historical basis for this relationship is crucial for contextualizing China's role in African development today.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. We just heard Sanyika of the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Next up is Mick Kelly of the Freedom Road Socialist Organization.
On January 20th, Trump stood in the Capitol Rotunda promising a golden age of imperialism and vowed to stop the decline of the U.S. empire, which in fact is something that he cannot and will not do. It's impossible. In fact, the opposite is the case. Trump and company will in fact accelerate the decline of American imperialism, of monopoly capitalism, and increased military spending, the deployment of more military forces to the Pacific will not change that. Overall, the long-run decrease in economic power will be followed by a decline in political power. That's a general principle. The role of the United States in the world economy is shrinking. It's declining in an absolute sense. In 1960, the U.S. had about 40% of the world GDP. Today, it's about half that. The reality is the U.S. has abandoned projects that put it at the center of the international economy. A great example of that is the World Trade Organization, which many of us fought. And I think at this point, we can say it's kind of arriving at its end. Likewise, the 2017 withdrawal from the Trans-Pacific Partnership was something that was carried out 8 days into the last Trump administration is another symptom of deterioration. The relative weakness of the U.S. economy in the world today is actually accompanied by a fragmentation of the world economy, and in fact, the rise of inter-imperialist contradictions. Looking at the statistics from the International Monetary Fund to compare the size of respective economies, People's China has in fact surpassed that of the U.S. using the metric of purchasing power parity, PPP for short, which allows us to compare what commodities and services can be purchased with a given currency. We can see that in 2024, China had about 19% of the world GDP, while the U.S. had declined to about 14%. One could also look at a host of industries, from auto to shipbuilding to steel to green technologies, and see that the United States is being left behind. And in fact, just give one additional example. If I remember correctly, China has about 50 times the shipbuilding capacity as the United States, which is, on many levels, a truly remarkable thing. And so when we are looking at U.S. policy and plans in the Pacific in general, I think there's two things that we need to keep a handle on or keep in mind in terms of what's coming next. First of all, there's a fair amount of overlap on China policy pursued by the Democratic and Republican politicians. While we can say with some confidence that Trump will be unmatched when it comes to xenophobia, chauvinism, warlike rhetoric, there's a certain reality, which is that both administrations, the Biden administration, the Trump administration, have had policies that are roughly similar. For example, when U.S. Defense Secretary Austin was testifying in the 2024 Defense Appropriation Bill in front of the Senate Armed Forces Committee, he stated this: "This is a strategy-driven budget, one that is driven by the seriousness of our strategic composition with the People's Republic of China." And so the second issue I think that it's important to keep in mind is the whole issue of Taiwan province. And that's really the great unsolved issue of the Chinese Revolution. It's something that remains to be done. And there's a reality here too, which is the U.S. has long encouraged the most reactionary and separatist forces as part of a project to contain China. And Chinese Communist Party Secretary Xi Jinping was entirely right to say, the people on both sides of the Taiwan Strait are one family, and you can never sever our family bonds. No one can stop the historical trend to China's reunification. The Communist Party of China has also made it clear that this separatism will not be allowed to flourish forever. Biden also stated that the U.S. would intervene in a conflict to reunify China militarily. And Trump has said, well, China's very afraid of me, so nothing possibly can happen. Myself, I agree with Xi Jinping. Reunification, it's inevitable. Looking at the issue of tariffs and trade, and it's for me, it's kind of a funny thing at a late age in my life to become very interested in things like tariffs when I have spent a lot more of my life devoted to trade union questions, but tariffs are important. And countries enact tariffs, and they generally do so to protect internal markets for the purpose of industrial development. But monopoly capitalist powers in decline have a different reason to do so. What they want to do is protect internal markets when they have failing industries and industries that have low levels of productivity. And in China, exactly the opposite is taking place. For example, let me take the steel industry. China has built an extraordinarily advanced steel industry that's much greater than the United States. The United States steel industry in many places looks like it's from an antique museum. It's really something that's lagging behind. And so there's a reality is the U.S. is now putting lots and lots of tariffs on Chinese steel. It's not really competitive. The Biden administration kept many of the China tariffs from the first Trump administration. I think Danny mentioned that. Biden actually upped tariffs on things like electric vehicles and aluminum. Now Trump, he bills himself as tariff man, somebody who has vowed to take this whole thing to another level. So he talks about 60% tariffs, 100% tariffs on electric vehicles. He talks about 25% tariffs. But probably most significantly, he's talking about 10% all-around tariffs on February 1st. And I think that's something we're going to have to see. But one impact of tariffs for sure is going to be an upward pressure on prices in the United States. And many of us here are tired of inflation and we're tired of these conditions. And one thing that tariffs will not do is bring back industry. Certainly there can be some impact in that regard, but it will not. And the reason is simple. That basically, with the development of the productive forces, with the development of automation, many of the industries that we're talking about, the manufacturing we talk about, will not bring back a great addition of jobs. So tariffs are not going to do what Trump says they're going to do. There is also an important political and military dimension to this whole thing of delinking the economies and protecting supply chains. And it's also worth noting, and I think this is in terms of a terrain of struggle in the US, that one of the factors in prolonging the Great Depression of the 1930s was high tariffs. And I think in many ways, the US is overdue for an economic decline. It's been about 10 years since there's been a major crisis, and maybe a little bit more actually. And the US typically has them every 5 to 7 years. Taking a look at kind of some of the future developments that we can expect, one of them will be a continuation of the massive military buildup that's taking place in the Pacific. And it's going to be things like increased defense spending, things like basing more missiles, for example, the Typhoon missiles, which are being based in the Philippines. And it's stuff like the Pacific Deterrence Initiative. And there's no reason to think that the Trump administration is going to slow down on the armament program that the Biden administration has had. General U.S. Strategy, in addition to the arms race, has been drawing the countries of the Pacific region into hostile alliances, formal and informal, against China. Some of the other speakers have already mentioned them. But I think Trump is going to have some challenges doing that, not because there's all sorts of progressive countries everywhere, but rather because Trump is not good for his word. And I think it's going to be more difficult for him to pull together different alliances to oppose China. On the balance, it can be said that the U.S. is on the road to greater conflict with China, and the possibility of the U.S. provoking a major war cannot be ruled out. In fact, it's a likely consequence of the direction things that are now heading. So to wrap it up, progressives, revolutionaries, those of us in the anti-war movement, we need to stand with China. China has done nothing wrong. In fact, it's developing socialism and working for peace. And no surprise, China has friends all over the world, including, I'm certain, on this Zoom call and in Portland. We are going to have a busy time ahead of us these next 4 years. We have an enemy in the White House that wants to wage a war on China, on the peoples of the world, and the people here at home. It's our job to make sure, to be certain, that this war is not a one-sided one. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. We just heard Mick Kelly of the Freedom Road Socialist Organization. Next up is Sarah Flounders of the International Action Center.
I want to begin today with a salute to the incredible historic victory of the United Palestinian Resistance, because it confirms to all the people of the world that revolutionary morale and determination are stronger than billions in high-tech weapons that U.S. imperialism provided to its Israeli proxies. The enormous power, as a best example, unleashed by the Chinese Revolution, its mobilization of the most oppressed, led by the Chinese Communist Party, is a real driving force in China's rapid modernization and leap from grinding poverty, illiteracy, famines, and imperialist dismemberment. It's people's power that changes history, and sharply. Just as Palestinians struggling for their land are labeled terrorists in Western propaganda, debunking the notion that China is just a vicious imperialist country is a crucial part of opposing the US narrative. The imperialist countries pump the China threat relentlessly and use it to justify a war mobilization against China. So we need to deal with this head on. This is a demoralizing, disorienting slur at a time when we need to be uniting the broadest possible forces against US-led war. What we defend in China is what Wall Street wants to destroy. Many on this panel defended China when it was an overwhelmingly impoverished, largely illiterate peasant country, storming the heavens with revolutionary fervor that inspired millions around the world. The Chinese Revolution was a world historic, massive social upheaval. And we defended China for the same reason that we defend every gain of the working class, every painful step forward for our class, every organizing drive, every union struggle, every liberation movement, because we take sides in the class struggle. It's a global struggle. Now, none of these struggles are picture perfect, they run up against real material limitations. But what's the difference, China and the US? China does not engage in regime change, destabilization, unilateral sanctions, economic coercion in pursuit of its economic interests. US does. China does not have a global infrastructure of military bases. US has more than 800 military bases, armed forts around the world. China's state-owned industries aren't driven to extract profit from every transaction. They're actually liberated to solve real problems and human needs. US corporations, every one of them, must extract profits for shareholders every quarter. Profits are their lifeblood. China is very open in admitting that they're building toward socialism. They're not yet a socialist country with full equality, where everyone's needs are met. The Chinese economy is still unevenly developed. As they explain, they're far from being a communist society, but they are using the vehicle of a workers' party, a communist party, to determinately improve conditions of life for millions of people. They make compromises. There's a capitalist class in China of some wealthy individuals, but the capitalists are not the deciders. China remains a workers' state with a socialist economic foundation, but it's forced to exist within the worldwide capitalist system. There's an irreconcilable difference in property relations, in class relations, in an imperialist country, and in an oppressed and formerly colonized country building a socialist economy. Now, the big question for Marxists is, who does the state serve? In China and here in the US. As Lenin stated, the question is, which class controls the state? That's absolutely vital in answering the question of whether or not China is an imperialist country. Now, all the top Chinese companies are state-owned, publicly owned by the whole people, not a handful of billionaires. And that includes the banks, the oil companies, gas companies, gold, rare earth minerals, insurance companies, the high-speed railroads. There's a state monopoly of trade, key industries like finance and technology and manufacturing, energy, aerospace, and chemicals. These are all state-owned enterprises in China. The rich resources and industries and essential communications, this is the largest source of profit in every society, and it's why the US wants to control it. And that's the source of their anger. It's all controlled and owned by the Chinese state for the benefit of all the people and not a handful of billionaires. There are now 600 million workers in China, and that's larger than the entire working class of all the G7 imperialist countries together. There's nearly 100 million Communist Party members who are elected by their peers at every level, who are committed to defending socialist property rights. They study Marxism in the most creative ways as an evolving science. The sheer size of a politically conscious, highly organized communist working class organizations and leadership, that's a powerful bulwark against imperialism. Now, capitalists from around the world can invest, make a lot of profit, but they can't just pull their equipment out. By law, China owns it, and Chinese staff must be trained to operate it. Imagine that. The imperialist corporations consider these restrictions on foreign investments to be property theft. They want to be able to do what they did inside the US, pull out their factories, their equipment, and technology, and leave behind a rust belt and millions of unemployed workers. They can't do that in China. Now, because China has maintained a planned economy and state ownership of core industries, it's been able to avoid the economic crises, those horrific recessions and depressions that hit all capitalist economies every 7 to 10 years. China's economy even weathered the 2008 capitalist crisis that brought finance capital to the brink of collapse. This is proof that the global capitalist market is not dominant and it's not the billionaires driving the decisions. Now, a few Chinese capitalists are actually allowed into the Communist Party of China, but that brings them under party discipline. And it's another mechanism by which the CCP can assert dominance over their corporations. China retains public ownership of all land. Land can be leased for a specific time, but what is built has to conform to a plan. China's Belt and Road Initiative, it really is liberation for the world, for the global South, for the formerly colonized countries. It's an attempt to connect China with other countries and to build up economic development of each country. Now, for 30 years, from 1949, the Chinese Revolution, to 1979, China's efforts at growth and modernization were made so much more difficult by the US-imposed sanctions, total blockade. But in those years, China reorganized a chaotic, war-torn, underdeveloped society, building technology, basic infrastructure, educating the working class and the vast peasantry. It's what made the next step possible. China's opening to investment in 1978 was conditioned on the West lifting its strangling economic sanctions that had barred all technology, industrial equipment, investment, and trade. It was a risk, a deal with the devil, especially because imperialism saw it as a possible way back into China. Now, through growing coordination of socialist planning over 75 years, the conditions of life for millions has steadily improved. Today, workers in China are benefiting enormously, 800 million people out of total grinding poverty. Wages in China have doubled in the last 10 years and the previous 10 years before that. And here, real wages in the US have stagnated since 1970s. Profits have soared, but so has inequality. In education, China produces more science, technology, engineering, math, the STEM graduates than the rest of the world combined. Now, consider debt. In the US today, almost all workers live their lives in debt. 41% are in medical debt. Millions are overwhelmed by student loans, car loans, paying mortgages, struggling to make rent. Loss of a job can quickly lead to homelessness. But for three generations, 75 years since 1949, Communist Revolution, debt is almost unknown in China among workers and peasants. Before the revolution, millions of people had been born into debt, carried the debt of their families, forced to sell themselves and their children to landlords to pay off debts. So we have a responsibility to answer the attacks on China. Endless war and militarism puts all workers at risk. If you're part of the workers' struggle here in the US, then you know the slogan, which side are you on? In the class struggle, it's essential to take sides and remember this essential distinction: people's needs and not capitalist profits.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. We just heard Sarah Flounders of the International Action Center. Next up is journalist and peace activist KJ Noh.
First thing I want to say is China's great accomplishments. This is the greatest people's success story in modern human history. And I want to emphasize that China liberated itself. It achieved developed status. It is only one of four formerly colonized countries or regions to achieve this status. Almost every country that was colonized has not managed to achieve a developed status. They've all stayed in a kind of neo-colonial underdeveloped status. And China did this without slavery, without colonization, without war, without invasion, without primitive accumulation. In other words, it developed on its own terms. It also tackled some extreme crises. 850 million people were brought out of poverty. In the 1980s, China was poorer than Haiti by GDP. And most people don't know this, but it ended the worst drug addiction problem on the planet. In 1949, 90 million people were addicted to opiates. That was about one-fifth of its population. And within 3 years, it got rid of the drug addiction problem. It's currently tackling global warming by creating a revolution in sustainable energy transition. In fact, what we're seeing is the greatest sustainable energy generation transition project on the planet. And it is offering renewables as an affordable global good. It has the greatest carbon capture project on the planet. Namely, it builds forests the size of Belgium every single year. And it's constantly developing new technologies such as molten salt reactors, plasma fusion generation. It's on the cutting edge of that. And nanotechnologies such as reclaiming lithium from seawater for the sustainable reclaiming of lithium. And of course, it's a scientific and economic powerhouse. The top scientific research publication comes out of China. ASPE, a China hostile think tank, says that 57 out of 63 critical cutting edge technologies are currently being led by the Chinese. And of course, it's a tech powerhouse. It's maintained technological information sovereignty despite sanctions, despite technological sanctions. And recently it released DeepSeek AI R1. It developed it at probably 100th or 1,000th of the development costs and 1/11th of the training costs. And it's released it as open source, which means that this is AI for everyone. It's opening up the knowledge commons as opposed to enclosing them, which is what you see with the US corporations. And all of this is a common benefit, but then you hear the refrain, at what cost? And of course, you also hear, but is it really socialist? And this is the kind of purity, fetishism, socialism. So I thought I would tackle that a little bit. There's a has-is fallacy. You know, I have something, therefore I am something is a fallacy. I have a dog, therefore I am a dog is a fallacy. The US has socialists, therefore it is socialist, is a fallacy. You cannot say China has capitalists, therefore it is capitalist. But people harp on this all the time. If you really want to think about it, you have to ask yourself, has or does any capitalist state have long-term planned economic development for common prosperity? Does any capitalist state have public ownership of land, infrastructure, public goods, the commanding heights of economy, and 60 to 70% of all corporations? Has any capitalist state avoided transitioning to a financialized rentier economy as it becomes monopolistic? Has any capitalist state avoided the capitalist burn and crash cycle of repeated recession? Has any capitalist state virtually eliminated hunger, poverty, illiteracy? Or does it use poverty to create wealth? Has any capitalist committed to ecological and sustainable development, writing that into its constitution? And has any capitalist state implemented a scientific approach to development using trial spots? The answer to all of the above is no. Therefore, China is not capitalist. Still, people insist, you know, they say China is imperialist, and Sanika gave a really, really good refutation of that. But I'll just kind of unpack a little bit of the genealogy of this. The people who claim China imperialist are like the people who shout reverse racism. That is, anything opposed to imperialism can only be from other imperialists, just as a challenge to racism must be racist at its foundation. So imperialists, they knee-jerk about reverse imperialism, China imperialist. That's the trope that you will hear from them. And it's like people who say all lives matter, you know, all imperialisms matter, even the ones that they imagine. And they cannot comprehend that escaping from American imperial violence should not be seen as an imperial threat, just as somebody who escapes from the police is not endangering the police. But this knee-jerk trope was given academic formulation by a US-funded anti-China scholar. His name is Ho-Fung Hong, and he was working out of the deep state think tank SAIS, at Johns Hopkins. He had illustrious genocidal colleagues like John Negroponte, Elliot Cohen, Madeleine Albright, and he published his work in foreign policy, and then it trickled out into dollar store lefty outlets like Jacobin, and then it circulated as low-rent tokens in the democratic socialist left and ultra-left and liberal circles, and then it reappropriated by right-wing think tanks. It's pure propaganda. There's nothing inter-imperial about this conflict because the U.S. is taking the conflict to China, and China is not imperialist, as others have pointed out clearly. The core fallacy, to boil it down to its simplest terms, is that imperialism and colonialism underdevelops the periphery. It impoverishes the periphery, which is exactly the opposite of what BRI and the indigenous sovereign development towards a counter-hegemonic world of multipolarity is doing. So when people use that fallacy, they're doing the work of the imperialists. And then we also always get these kind of ad hominem attacks. You know, they say tanky, and tanky simply means my mental gas tank is depleted, words and logic have failed me, all I can muster is invective. And there's a taxonomy. If we wanted to, you know, play the ad hominem game, there are crankies, stankies, wankies, twankies, skankies, and shankies. I won't go into all of them, but crankies are the ones that are really cranky and cantankerous. You know, wankies are white authoritarian crankies. Twinkies are obsessed with Taiwan province, and they believe in twin imperialism. Skankies want to school you, shankies want to shiv you, etc. We won't go into that. But then people also come on about, oh, what about workers' rights? And I just want to tell you a little story about my friend. He used to use a mayonnaise jar as his water bottle. And this hipster San Francisco dude went up to him and said, I hope you recycle that jar. And his head exploded because he has been using that mayonnaise jar as his water bottle for about 7 years. And he's never had to recycle it because he's never thrown it away. But this is the way that idiots think. They don't understand that if you have a people's republic, it builds wealth for its people, including its workers. And just one benchmark is Chinese manufacturing wages have risen 130-fold in 45 years versus 4 times. In other words, we're focusing on performance and outcomes, not a reified, mystified process that fetishizes institutions or some notion of process. You have in China what's called a whole process democracy that lifts up the bottom for everybody and creates common collective wealth. So I compare it to the way that voting is fetishized in the West. But just to look at the numbers, China's average wages have increased 12-fold since 2000. They've increased 250-fold, 24,000% since the 1950s. Manufacturing wages have nearly doubled in the past 10 years. They have increased 10-fold since 2000, and they have increased over 130-fold since 1980, 12,000%, as opposed to U.S. wages, which have, you know, essentially quadrupled since 1980. I will take 12,000% over 300% any time of the day or night. Same thing for minimum wage. U.S. federal minimum wage has flatlined since 2007, has not increased in purchasing value since 1980, whereas in China, since 2006, almost the same period, it's increased 250%. And of course, China has the longest post-retirement life expectancy between 18 to 28 years. Blue-collar women workers can retire at 50, men can retire at 55, and others retire between 60 and 63. So the life expectancy increases at the same time that people can expect to have a post-work retirement. So this is extraordinary, and these are things that are accomplished without the U.S. fetishization. So it's far better to be a worker in China than in the United States. And salaries and public wealth makes life in China much, much more livable. 70% of Chinese millennials own their own home, twice the rate of the US, and between 90 and 96% of Chinese households own their own home, usually without owning a penny. But we are in a kind of a full-on preparation for war. And in information war, the idea is to create a no-think zone or a no-critical thinking zone, just as in real war, you have a no-fly zone. And so we're very, very accelerated in that process. And of course, you also see desperation in the empire. South Korea recently just saw an attempted military coup. And this is one of a string of attempted coups across the world, in Bulgaria, Hungary, Bangladesh, even France had an election. And then the ruling party refused to give up power after losing the election. And you see attempts to revert to dictatorships. You see this in Taiwan, you see this in the Philippines, you see this in Korea. And in particular, Korea is very important because Korea has 500,000 active duty troops and 3.1 million reserve troops. And all of these troops fall under US control the moment the US declares DEFCON 3 under conditions of war. Now, South Korea's recent attempt at martial law, i.e. a military coup, was predicated on creating the semblance of an attack from North Korea, a false flag attack from North Korea, and then creating kinetic engagement. And therefore, South Korea would have had a military dictatorship, it would have had a war with North Korea, and under those conditions, all of South Korea's troops would have fallen under US operational control, with which the US could have waged war against China, or it could have sent those troops to Ukraine to fight against, quote unquote, the North Koreans who are fighting for Russia, but who are more elusive than the aliens at Roswell. In fact, it's just a complete canard that they've manufactured. And this explains why you have this lie. So anyway, we're in a very, very dangerous situation. We have to stay in solidarity with and for China. The future of the world depends on it. And part of that is fighting the lies, fighting the information war, and decolonizing your mind, not letting your mind become occupied, because the US military considers mental space a theater of contestation. Do not let your mind be occupied with anti-China propaganda. Thank you, everybody.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent, and this episode was audio from a webinar titled Defend Socialist China. We just heard journalist and peace activist KJ No. The webinar was sponsored by Friends of Socialist China and hosted by UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition. I'm Wilton Vaught, saying thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.